This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
These are great days for us. We have so much to be thankful for. And as a way to prepare our hearts, this kind of campaign gives me an opportunity to talk about a subject that we don't often talk about, and that is finances and stewardship. Typically for us, it's the next chapter, the next verse, maybe the next book of the Bible, or maybe the biography of David that we have set aside for these 2 weeks. But it gives us an opportunity to address something very, very, very important. In fact, it's at times like these, I have to give you a little insight into my own heart as a pastor. It's at times like these that I feel a little bit like a failure because I haven't addressed the subject of stewardship and finance. And as I look at my notes and the record of what I've preached through, the last time I did was the last time we had a campaign, which is about 8 years ago now, 6 to 8 years ago. So I know you've been waiting for this, haven't you? With bated breath, you're excited to be here this Lord's Day, aren't you? Yeah, thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that very much. In fact, if we could put you in the middle of the audience, it'd be just perfect. Well, what I want to do is deal with a subject that actually is very close to the heart of our chief shepherd, the Lord. Consider the fact that half of his parables that he taught had to do with money and possessions. In fact, if you took Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, put all the verses together, and then on average, you discover that 1 out of 10 of them deal with the subject of money and possessions. In fact, one researcher offered the fact that there are about 500 verses of Scripture on the subject of prayer. There are 2,000 on the subject of money and possessions. Evidently, the Lord wants us to get it right. And He wants us to think about it probably more often than we do. In fact, it's interesting to me that the way you and I handle money has a greater impact on our spiritual life than we might allow to penetrate beneath the surface of our conscious thinking. Our walk with God is often stymied because of financial issues. Our faith is often restricted. Our prayers are often nothing more or less than self-interested wish lists of what we want God to do for us. So if the Lord were to show up today, 1 out of every 2 times He'd visit, He would talk on a subject like this. And so let's take a variety of texts and we'll turn to them quicker than probably you can keep up. But I want to give you 5 or 6 principles on this subject of stewardship. And I want to ask, because I've asked the Lord, for you to take these, let them resonate in your heart. Think about them over the next few days, especially as we come back next Lord's Day to make a decision together. Now, what I'm going to tell you is not something brand new. In fact, if you're older in the faith, you're going to say, I already knew that. So this will be a refresher course. If you're new in the faith, it'll be new to you. But I will tell you this, these principles have impacted my life in just rehearsing them in my own heart over these past few weeks. Here it is. First of all, first principle, whatever you have is the sovereign will of a gracious God. Whatever you have is the sovereign will of a gracious God. Psalm chapter 75, David puts it like this at verse 6. Not from the east, not from the west, not from the mountains comes promotion, but God puts one down and raises up another. It's an interesting concept that your promotion out there in the workforce is determined by God, which would mean your demotion. The fact that you have a job or don't is according to His purposes. Job will speak to this issue. He is in the crucible of suffering. He has lost everything financially. He's lost his businesses. He's lost his staff and his crew and his health. And he says it this way in chapter 23. God is unique. And who can change Him? Or you could translate it, who can turn Him? What His soul desires that He does. He performs what is appointed for me. By the way, there isn't any greater comfort when you're in the crucible of suffering than coming to understand the fact that you're there according to the sovereign will of God. That you're not there because He lost sight of you, or He lost track of you, Or this is an accident and he really didn't intend that for you. No, the greatest comfort is in knowing, as Job learned, that he will perform what is appointed for me. Well, let's just bring it down on a practical level. Listen, there are godlier people. There are godlier people than you who earn less than you do, who have less than you have. In fact, we can make it even a little bit more confrontive. There are smarter people out there who earn less wages than you, right? Maybe you're not convinced. There probably are. There are better administrators. There are more gifted people today in this assembly who do not have a job, and you do. See, understanding this principle brings you to humility and gratitude, not pride and sort of the self-interested, well, God's giving me everything I deserve. You see, that's what the enemy of your soul and mind wants you to think when you look in the mirror, or you pull into that parking spot, or you pull into that office or a cubicle. He wants you to think you're getting what you deserved, and you deserve it more than someone else. Now, the truth is, whatever we have is determined by the gracious will of God, who is fulfilling his short-term and his long-term purposes in your life and mine. And having that refresher course brings you back to a place of humility and gratitude. Or perhaps trust that he hasn't lost sight of you. James the Apostle puts it this way. He says, don't have this attitude where you're going to say, I'm going to go to this city or that city and I'm going to start a business and I'm going to bring in a handsome profit. He says, no. Say it this way. If the Lord wills, I will do such and such. Whatever we have is the sovereign will and according to the sovereign purposes of our gracious Lord. A second principle that follows closely along with this first principle is this. Whatever you have actually belongs to God anyway. Now, we already know that, but let's just refresh our memory. Whatever we have actually belongs to God in the first place. It's his. And Moses summarizes it in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 10. He says, look, or translated, behold, look around. The Lord your God, to whom belongs heaven and the furthest heaven, which means you go outside and the furthest out you can see, get a telescope, look even further beyond. And then he says, and the earth and all that is in it belongs to him. You can't say it any more comprehensively than that. Everything you can see out there and everything you can see on the planet, by the way, it all belongs to him. Which means he's allowing us to manage his property, his money, his people, for the sake of his name and reputation. Some of you have perhaps read that little orange book that was handed out to the adults in our ABFs, and you may have seen them around on tables, by Chip Ingram on the subject of stewardship. He gives an illustration in there that I'll pull out of that, because it was just a profound illustration. In fact, it's one of those things he used to pastor, and this happened when he was a pastor, that really doesn't happen to pastors, and it's a pastor's dream, I suppose. Will it actually happen to him? Here's what happened. A wealthy gentleman in his congregation came to him, said, let's go out and have lunch. Went out to lunch, and he said, I don't want anybody to know this. I don't want anybody to send me thank you notes. I don't want anybody to write me letters. I don't want requests to come to me. But I want to deposit some money in a checking account. And then I'm going to get a checkbook without any name or address on it. And I'm going to give it to you, and I want you to spend my money. When you see a need, when you meet someone, when something surfaces, you pull out that checkbook and you write a check for that. I mean, wouldn't that be fun? Like, give me your checkbook afterward. I'd really love to do that as your pastor, okay? And whenever you see somebody in need, or somebody could use some help, or just something to encourage someone, use my checkbook, my money, and give it to them. So Chip begins this amazing period that lasted several years in his ministry where he literally touched the lives of hundreds of people. He would tell them, it isn't my money. It's for someone that wants to remain anonymous. But I've seen this need. I've seen this surface in your life. Or here's something I knew you wanted to do but couldn't quite do it. And I want to give you money. Every once in a while, three or four times a year, this older gentleman would call Chip up and say, okay, let's have lunch. They'd go out to lunch, and this guy would say to him, okay, I want to hear it. Tell me what's going on. And Pastor Ingram would just tell him one story after another of what God was doing with his money as Chip managed it. And every lunch would end the same way. He said, that man would tell me, okay, it's great. I'm going to put some more money into that account, and you continue managing it for me as you give it away. And keep me posted. Are we not all doing that same thing? Aren't we in that same position, managing God's things? Trouble is, we don't think about it that way, do we? We are literally, as the Apostle Peter said in chapter 4 and verse 10 of his first letter, we are stewarding the manifold grace of God. One day, we're going to stand before him and give an account with what we did with his property, his money, his things. We easily forget we are stewarding that which belongs to someone else. Tomorrow morning, we're going to try to beat the rush hour on I-40 and get to the airport and take an early flight out to a pastor's conference in New England. And I'll get in there early afternoon and speak four times, starting at 1:30. I'll end up around 9:30 and then go to bed, get up in the morning, speak a couple more times. That conference will end. I'll grab a flight and around 5:10, according to my itinerary, and I'll land here around 10 o'clock. Hopefully by that time I'll be at the house, kiss my wife goodbye, hello, and hello, and tell her all that I did. I'll be on four different airplanes according to my itinerary. Now that's if it all works. The last time I flew out and came through that airport, I ended up, this is a year ago, having to rent a vehicle to drive home or spend the night with some wonderful people in the airport there that also didn't have another flight connection home. So this is optimism, I know, but I'm going to be on four planes to go and come. Now, four times, more than likely a woman's going to walk down my aisle and she's going to ask me if I'd like something to drink. And I'm going to say, absolutely. If I feel like I need to have something, you know, healthy, I'll order some cranapple juice. If I'm feeling rebellious, I'll order a Coke and drink that. Then a little later, she's going to come back and she's going to offer me a bag of peanuts. Obviously, I'm not in first class. Did you catch that? Up there, they've got a basket with a variety of cookies and granola, but not me. And I'm going to ask her for three packages so that I can combine them together and have 13 peanuts. That's my plan, okay? Now, do you think for a moment that that woman considers those peanuts and those soft drinks hers? Would she ever say, listen, everything on this cart belongs to me, and I've decided on this flight from Baltimore to RDU, I'm going to keep it all for myself. And then she plops down in an empty seat and begins opening can after can and eating peanuts and filling her pockets. And it's all her. We just sit there in amazement. There's one word to describe that woman. Unemployed, right? Because that would be her last flight. That isn't her stuff. She is stewarding what belongs to a company on behalf of their name to people like us. Is it possible that we're so busy stuffing ourselves with the benefits of God, whatever they may be, filling our pockets and our houses and our garages with all that stuff as if it belonged to us. Forgetting that whatever we have actually belongs to God to manage on His behalf. Maybe you're thinking, okay, I don't like these campaigns, but I'll pledge next Lord's Day. No, not so fast. Let me give you a newsflash. We'll call this principle number three. Number three, if your attitude isn't right, whatever you give won't matter to God. In writing to the Corinthians, the Apostle Paul challenged them in his second letter on giving financially, and he wrote this rather interesting statement that actually goes beyond money. It actually talks about the kind of people we become. He who sows sparingly reaps sparingly. He who sows bountifully, generously, reaps bountifully. Every time I've ever heard that passage preached, the preacher puts a period there and preaches a little bit, and then we go home and have lunch. That is what Paul does. Now, he is saying, don't be stingy. Be generous. Be generous. But Paul didn't put a period there. In fact, that statement is going to clarify his next statement. He says, but let each one of us, as we purpose in our heart, give, not grudgingly, or of necessity, or under compulsion. God wants cheerful givers. He admires, He loves, He honors those who give with that kind of attitude. So if you put it together, Paul is basically saying to these believers in Corinth, and certainly to us, be generous. Don't be a stingy person. You reap what you sow. You sow sparingly, you're stingy in that way, you become a stingy little package all wrapped up with me. Be generous with your life and what you have. And so as you purpose to give, don't give grudgingly. That's the person who says, you know, I really hate to give, but I guess I will. Or of necessity, that is under compulsion. That's the person who says, I don't want to give, but I feel pressured. You know, we got all these, you know, green things around. So I'm under pressure, so I guess I'll give. No, Paul says this rather startling conclusion, which is implicit in the text. If that's you, don't give. And a true shepherd is not going to encourage people to give with the wrong attitude if we can somehow twist their arm hard enough till they cry uncle. Will be satisfied. No. And I want to be true to this text too and tell you that unless your attitude is right and that you want to give in this respect with cheerfulness, give. If not, don't. How you give is more important than how much you give. And don't misunderstand, he wants us to be generous. What we have left over matters. That's where stinginess comes into play, or generosity. But how you give and with what spirit you give, God says, oh, that matters. Let me give you another New Testament principle of possessions. This might be a little more confrontive. Number four, the more you keep to yourself, the more you're going to want to have. The more you keep, the more you're going to want to have. Take it from Solomon. If I could go back into the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 5, here is Solomon. He's swimming in money. He's swimming in gold. He makes gold and silver as common as pebbles. Servants' clothing, horses, houses, everything. And he writes, as an older man, this interesting statement from which we draw this principle. He says this, he who loves money, that is, lives for it, will not be satisfied with money. In other words, it's self-defeating. Nor he who loves abundance with its income. He wrote earlier in life, the eyes of a man are never satisfied. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 20. So what do you want? If you live for income, if you live for things, if you long for things, those will never satisfy. You'll always want one more thing. Newer things. Shinier things. More fashionable things. You know, the latest. the best. You remember thinking, perhaps when you were younger, this idea, you know, if I got that raise, if I could get that raise, that'll do it. And then you got that raise. Did it do it? You think of all the raises over time. Did it raise your level of giving? Or did it simply raise your standard of living? The truth is, the more you have, the more you want. Principle number 5. The more you possess, the greater your obligations that you feel. Solomon put it this way in Ecclesiastes 5 verse 12. The sleep of a working man is pleasant, whether he has a little, eats a little, or eats or has much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. What's he saying? He isn't against a full stomach or a good meal, or being in management versus working hourly, as he uses the illustration here. He's simply stating an obvious principle. The lack of pressure and the lack of worry of an ordinary employee is remarkably contrasted with the one who owns the business. Maybe you've been in both places. You'd show up at work, you'd clock in, you'd clock out, and how much did you think about how that company was doing that afternoon and evening? Absolutely none. The owner, however, and maybe you're a business owner, when do you ever stop thinking? You see, you have greater possessions, and with that comes greater obligations. Solomon isn't saying, okay, everybody go work, you know, by the hour. What he's doing is he is simply stating an obvious fact that we overlook in our rush to have more. Vanderbilt said it this way. He's basically learning what Solomon had learned, and he says this, and I quote, "The care of $200 million is enough to kill anyone. There is no pleasure in it." You might be thinking, well, let me help you out a little bit. I think I might get a little pleasure out of it. In other words, his maid probably slept better than he did with all he had to worry about. Henry Ford put it this way. He said, "I was happier when I was doing a mechanic's job." You understand what he's saying? This principle here. What Solomon had learned, the more you have to worry about. The more your wealth grows, the more opportunities you have for your worry to grow. Years ago, when my wife and I moved here to plant this church, we drove a used pickup truck that her father had given us. Her father worked on the Ford assembly line for decades. And he gave us his Ford F-150. It was older, it was used. But we were so glad for it because that's what we had. That's all we had. And I got to tell you, though, those memories. Now, in fact, I have a picture of three of my kids in the back of that pickup in my office, sitting in my office on a shelf. I love that Ford F-150. In fact, I've tried to figure out what year it was. I'm not quite sure. He gave it to us when it was used and old, rusted. But it worked. The air conditioner didn't, but everything else did. The hood of that truck was a rust brown. The rest of it was blue. Until you got near the back wheels, and then big rust holes were there just above the wheels. So grateful for that, and I loved it. I did have another problem. The brake pedal would, once I parked it, went inside, would just slowly depress. Until finally the back lights would come on, and if I didn't do something about it, the battery would be dead when I'd come back out of the church office. So I, don't tell anybody, but I took a hymnal and I propped that back, that pedal up so I wouldn't lose. Well, at any rate, I never washed that truck. I never washed it. It rained enough times a year to keep it clean. And if you have a vehicle that you've had like that, right? It rains enough times to keep it clean. Well, I gotta confess to you, I now drive a new Chevy pickup. Some would say I'm moving up in the world. Others would say I'm in sin, backsliding against God for driving a Chevy instead of a Ford. Well, you work that out with the Lord yourself. But at any rate, I don't want this truck to get dirty. It doesn't rain enough to keep it clean, and rain isn't sufficient, and it doesn't do a good enough job. In fact, I don't want it to rain on it, especially after I've, you know, had it cleaned. But I don't have time to clean it. I don't have time. So for $6.99, Auto Bella saved my life. I can go there, and they can clean it, and it'll be just right. You know what? I never used to think about that. That Ford pickup truck was just there. I got in it and drove to work and drove home. Now I'm thinking, this one's dirty. I got to spend time. It's taking thought. That's the point. You buy a brand new TV, flat screen, smart TV, what do you got to do? You got to watch it. You don't need to do that. Give it to me. I'll watch it. No, I'm teasing you. You buy a new set of golf clubs, what do you got to do with them? You got to use them. If you don't, you made a dumb investment, right? You still made a dumb one, probably. But at any rate, you're out there on the golf course. Why? Because I bought this new putter, and I've got to use it. You buy that vehicle, you've got to take care of it. You buy a boat, what do you got to do? You got to spend time on it, because if you don't spend time on it, you've wasted your money. You buy that cottage in the mountains or at the coast or whatever, and what do you got to do? You got to go spend time in it. And repair it, take care of it, make that investment work. Again, those issues in and of themselves aren't wrong, but here's the principle, here's the point. The more you have, the more you have to worry about. The more investments of your time, the more demands upon your time and energy you've got to spend on that. Devoting all of that time and energy can become then the problem though, right? In fact, Cyprian, I love this quote, it's convicting, but it's just been 200 years since Jesus ascended, and you'd think the church would still be so fresh with the truth of his resurrection that they had their focus right where it ought to be. And yet Cyprian writes this, their possessions, speaking of Christians, hold them in chains, chains which shackle their courage and choke their faith and hamper their judgment and throttle their souls. They think of themselves as owners, whereas it is they who are owned. They are not the master of their property and money, but its slaves. Principle number six. The less you have, the easier it is to give away. You found that to be true? The less you have, the easier it is to share or give it away. If you had $100, could you give 10 of it away? Well, sure. If you made $5,000 last month, did you give $5,000 or $500 away? Or $600 or $400? Well, I don't know about that. If you made $100,000 last year, did you give $10,000, $11,000, $12,000, $8,000 away? Oh, now we're talking about real money. I don't know about that. Reminded me of the barnyard animals who decided to get together and provide breakfast for their beloved farmer. The hen said, look, I'll provide some eggs. And the cow said, I'll give milk and butter. Then they looked at a rather quiet pig. And what about you? And he said, fellas, look, you know, guys, gals, for you, it's an offering. For me, it is total commitment. I thought it was interesting that Time magazine ran this. I clipped it, an article that proved this point that Paul is going to bring up, in fact, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. But he said this, the article said this, Americans who made less than $10,000 a year gave 5% of their income to charitable organizations, the church being the primary recipient. It's about $40 a month. In other words, they brought home about $800 a month, and they gave 40 away, which at this point in time is the highest category of giving in American culture, 5%. That's the top. Those who earned between 10,000 and 20,000 a year gave 3% of their income, down from 5.2 to be exact. And those who earn more than $75,000 a year give 1.6%. Why? Because we're talking about real money. And if I'm going to give a reflection of that to the Lord, it can't be a tip. The average Christian in America, based on all the research data for 2013, the average Christian is giving 1.2% a year. Paul says to the church in Corinth, he says of the Macedonians in illustrating for the Corinthians this idea of living beyond yourself. He says, look, they gave from their deep poverty. They were poor. They gave from their deep poverty for the saints in Jerusalem, the church. In the wealth of their liberality, he says. So what are we really sacrificing? Do we tip God, which for the average person is $20 a week, maybe $100 a month, $1,200 a year? Are we giving something that really reflects a commitment? You'd think, we're talking about this campaign of eliminating debt and putting more money into ministry along the way because we don't want to wait until we've eliminated it. How do you get to $10 million? I couldn't help but be marked by the fact, and this is hypothetical and it doesn't really factor out perfectly, but let me just put this down on the bottom shelf. If we all participated, if every household participated, this goal would be reached. In fact, I just pulled out a little calculator and I thought, okay, if 1,200 households, that's about half of the households that even claim us as their church, that's just half of them. If just half of the households decided to give $50 a week for the next 32 months, that'd be $10 million. Now, the truth is some households can't give that. Some would be giving a tip if that's all they gave. The issue isn't everybody giving the same amount. It isn't equal giving. It is equal sacrifice. But together, it's pretty remarkable what we can do. And I've got to tell you this, because I preached to myself before I ever preached to you. I would be crushed to think that next Lord's Day, as we pledge, that there would be a family or two or more that would really, deeply sacrifice, and I would not. As you pray and consider your part, let me give you two closing applications to think through, and then we're done. First, use this campaign as an opportunity to get real about your record of giving, okay? Whether you pledge or not, I think it'd be a good exercise to get real with your record. Now, we've just come through tax time, so we're already pretty real about our record of giving, aren't we? Because it's been tabulated for us and deducted. And we have another year where that may be the case again. Don't hide from this. Go home and pull out your records, your bank account records, and measure it out. Are you 1%, 1.3, 1.6, 2? You might think you're giving more, but what are you giving? Are you giving a tip? Or does it really reflect loyalty and love and passion and commitment? Does it actually reflect that you're thinking about the gospel, the church, and the work of Christ that we're able to do together? Secondly, use this campaign not only as an opportunity to get real about your record of giving, but use it as a time to make a resolution that reveals a new heart, perhaps a new attitude for God. And I can't think of anything that reflects the genuineness of some resolution than to say, I will invest my money in that.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.